Hi, and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk, a podcast for special needs and ADHD parents. In this episode, I speak to a former colleague of mine from my time in England many, many years ago. Dr. Matthew Brown is an education psychologist in Bristol, UK, and we speak about the role of an education psychologist within special educational needs. We also speak about emotional literacy support assistants, who are specialist teaching assistants that help children express their feelings and anxieties to help alleviate emotional outbursts in school. And now there's nothing for it but to get on with the show.
Can you briefly explain what an education psychologist does in terms of special educational needs?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. It's like it's one of those ones, it's kind of a misleading title and a slightly confusing role, because like the education bit kind of puts this kind of idea that it is just about learning and the education side of things, because there's a lot of sort of developmental stuff in there as well. But basically we're practitioner psychologists, so HCPC registered, doctoral trained, the same as clinical psychologists, but instead of working in like clinical settings, you know, like CAMHS and the NHS and stuff like that, we work in education settings, generally school age, but a little bit of early years and a little bit of college as well. So we have a role with kids with SEN, but it's typically, I guess, a role of assessment. So kind of we're outsiders that are brought into the school when kids are having issues or young people, issues around learning, as I say, that's part of it, but also kind of behaviour, social, emotional development, and more so these days, mental health and wellbeing. So there's that assessment role. But in terms of the SEN part, one of the roles that we have, and I guess some of your listeners would be aware of, is around assessments for education healthcare plans. And that is becoming an increasing part of the role just because of the quantity and pressures coming from that. But it's really only a small slice of what we can do, because that is assessment which informs intervention, but it's not the intervention in and of itself, if that makes sense.
So can you, as an education psychologist, can you diagnose children, or does a clinical psychologist do that?
Yeah, so there are some services and some EPs that would be more actively involved in the diagnostic process. We tend not to be, to be honest, within our service, we don't at all. And as a profession, we're kind of shifting away from that. But no, we traditionally wouldn't be involved. We may be consulted with by CAMHS and NHS sort of staff as a part of an assessment. So thinking about things like autism, they'd want to be looking at sort of triangulating evidence from different contexts and different professionals. So we might be consulted as a part of that. But no, we wouldn't normally be involved in diagnosis.
Okay. It's interesting to hear all about it, you know, different psychologists and assessments and all sorts of things, and I'd imagine it's quite overwhelming for parents.
It's really tricky, and I think, you know, speaking in terms of the UK, there's an additional complication with a bit of kind of process and bureaucracy behind things, that sometimes diagnoses aren't always recognized. So, you know, we get some private EPs and other psychologists that would be making assessments, but then that wouldn't necessarily be recognized by NHS services to get you access to kind of the parts that are there, if that makes sense. So it's a minefield for parents, and actually, you know, I really feel for parents that feel they need to go down that private assessment route to only then kind of find that it hasn't opened the doors that they're expecting it to.
Must be frustrating. All right. So when I got in touch with you to ask you if you would do a podcast, I then looked you up, and just to see what exactly was going on over there in Bristol, and I saw that you are training what are known as ELSAs.
Frozen.
No, not like Frozen. Can you explain briefly what an ELSA does?
Yeah, God, they've got an interesting role. So ELSAs are emotional literacy support assistants. So they're basically, you know, learning support assistants that are working in schools, and they are trained to fulfill a role in school to support kind of the emotional well-being of kids and young people. So they kind of work with some of the more challenging kids in schools. Around those areas of sort of social, emotional development, mental health, well-being, and so on. And I suppose they have a broader role than that. Might be useful in terms of explaining them and saying where they came from in the first instance. That it's about 20 years old now, the program, but it was educational psychologist Sheila Burton and some colleagues that developed the sort of training program. And what they were seeing was that in schools, this was in Hampshire, you know, some of the trickiest kids, the kids that had sort of behavior issues and social and emotional needs, ended up spending a lot of time out of class with learning support assistants who, with the most respect in the world, are kind of the least trained person in the classroom. And they thought, hang on, this is an issue. We've got some of the most complex kids in school being supported by some of the least trained people. And they wanted to do something about that. So they kind of developed this training package, thinking, you know, these LSAs are already working with these kids. Let's upskill them, give them a little bit of psychoeducation, cover a load of stuff that would be useful for them, and then give them ongoing sort of professional supervision.
So forward thinking, you know, for 20 years ago or so, that's...
Yeah, and that's still the model that I really like, and I think where the value is, you know, it's kind of supportive adults in schools who are getting clinical supervision and peer support from other people doing the same job. It has shifted over the years, and as with everything, there's like a kind of outcome and target setting component to it now, that people like really time monitored evidence-based interventions to address kind of specific areas of difficulty for kids. But the main part is still the same, you know, supportive adults working in school, serving the school community. That's the best way to do it, from people who know the kids and the community, as opposed to outsiders like myself coming in.
Wow. And can you just explain briefly what emotional literacy is?
So emotional literacy is, it's basically just our ability to kind of understand and express our emotions. So it's like a sort of self-awareness thing a little bit, about being able to kind of monitor our own internal states, what we're feeling, have the language around what that is so we can communicate it. And also, I guess, a bit of sort of self-regulation, you know, the so what part of that, like, you know, I'm feeling anxious about something. How can I kind of manage that, that feeling? How can I respond to it appropriately? Keep myself calm, keep myself going.
Okay, so it's like first recognizing how you're feeling and then maybe verbalizing it and then coming up with a solution to it.
Yeah, that's and it. Just, yeah, recognizing what's going on for us and managing it.
Fantastic. It sounds really great. And how helpful is emotional literacy for children with special educational needs?
I mean, it's hugely helpful for anyone, and I suppose, you know, it can be more of an issue for kids with SEN, with special educational needs, because, you know, there's a range of things going on there, but think about children with learning disabilities and speech and language needs, then they're going to struggle even more with the expression part of things. And I was thinking about this when you asked about doing the podcast, and I was kind of thinking, you know, one of the most obvious examples of the usefulness of emotional literacy is thinking about, you know, a toddler that's having a tantrum, you know, what they're doing there, they're experiencing something, some kind of distress or something's going on for them, but they're not able to communicate it effectively. So we see that kind of tantrum behavior. They don't have the words to kind of get it across. And I guess that kind of would ring true for some of the challenging behavior back when we used to work together. But you know, that we would say, isn't it, that challenging behavior has a communicative function. They just don't have the words to express what's going on. So you give them the vocabulary, teach them sort of to communicate what's going on for them, and then they'll be able to get that point across in more effective ways, and the behavior drops off. So yeah, it's enormously helpful. And thinking about as well in terms of adolescents and kids with social emotional needs, you know, I spend a lot of time working with teenagers, and you ask them to kind of comment on their emotional experiences, and the amount of times, you know, you work with teenagers that are, I don't know, I don't care. You know, they're not willing to engage with that. And you know, I get that, because it can be quite difficult, some of our emotions. And where emotional literacy is really important is kind of learning a little bit about why we have these things, learning that there aren't good or bad emotions. There aren't things to be avoided. You know, anxiety and fear and depression are kind of, they're there to keep us safe, aren't they? You know, these things evolved over a period of time and they need to be normalized. And I think, you know, that's a really key part of this as well. I'm always in danger of getting a little bit soapboxy at this moment. I think we've come so far in the last decade or so about mental health awareness, but the understanding really, really is kind of lagging behind, that there is still this idea about mental wellness, and that, you know, anxiety, fear and depression and all these things are things to somehow be avoided. And that's really not the case. It is the human experience. We can't be kind of blindly happy all the time. There are definitely times when it's appropriate to be fearful, to be cautious. I mean, we see a lot of figures in the press around the prevalence of mental health conditions in adolescents, for example. And I don't have the figures to hand, but it's kind of, it's quite alarming what you hear on the one hand, that, you know, this significant proportion of teenagers have mental health conditions, they say, you know, anxiety and depression. And then I think back to my own teenage life, and I think, geez, I'd be more concerned if teenagers didn't experience periods of acute anxiety and depression. I mean, I don't know if you can relate to that.
Yeah, like, definitely.
It's the normal thing. And what we're in danger of doing is stigmatizing as opposed to normalizing. So yeah, I'll get off my soapbox now.
No, it's interesting. It's interesting to hear your point of view on that. And maybe we'll invite you back on to talk about, you know, mental health for teenagers.
Yeah.
How helpful would it be for parents to work on their own emotional literacy?
It's hugely important, because I mean, kids first and foremost learn from their parents, don't they? You know, we model how to respond to these kind of things, and thinking, you know, about some slightly more uptight, repressive kind of upbringing that some of us may have had looking back, like you're taught, especially as a boy, that there are some things that aren't appropriate, which isn't cool, you know, that actually it's fine to express your emotions. There's also, you know, this bit as well for parents, and again, you know, speaking from my own experience, that like, you need to be in check of your own emotions to be able to kind of effectively respond to your kid. That if you're not in the best place yourself, if you can feel yourself getting angry or frustrated, that's the time when you're not going to be responding calmly and level-headed to something which is fairly insignificant in your child. So you kind of need to look after yourself before you get that other bite there.
Yeah, I can imagine. And children are so sensitive, aren't they, you know, but also they pick up on our anxiety and they just soak it up like little sponges, don't they?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And actually, that's a really good point in terms of the anxiety, because, yeah, spend a lot of time working with kids that may have anxiety. In some instances, you know, children that are refusing to go to school and in these like really entrenched patterns of avoidance. And quite often, not always, but quite often, you kind of see some of those traits in the parents. And I think that's a really good example in terms of, you know, the modelling of maybe not the most helpful approach to managing anxiety, because, you know, if there's something you're worried about, if you avoid it, you're going to feel a hell of a lot better in the short term, but it's not helpful in the long term. Yeah, so we'll definitely see little bits of that from, yeah, parent to child.
Elsa's, do they work in mainstream schools as well with seeing kids?
Yeah, generally speaking.
Yeah. Generally speaking, okay.
Yeah, and I think there's a part in there that actually a lot of the work that they do does require a kind of, you know, a level of language, and thinking about some of our special schools, especially special schools for kids with learning disabilities, when the language isn't there, it would be really difficult to do some kind of emotional literacy work. It's not to say that there aren't kind of some sort of more visual systems that can be put in place for children with communication needs and learning disabilities, but yeah, our ELSAs, I'd say 95% of them are mainstream schools, and that other 5% would be kind of more in settings that are special schools, but for kids with social and emotional needs as opposed to learning needs.
Okay, so do teachers also have emotional literacy training?
Yeah, they should. They definitely should, and it's something that is, in the UK anyway, becoming higher on the agenda again. You know, there's a political component to it, but there is a compulsory requirement for schools to be doing PSHE and RSE, so like personal social health education. These kind of PSHE and mental health practices are becoming more high profile in schools, but also I'm aware teachers have huge pressures on them to get through the standard formal curriculum. You know, it's sometimes these activities are seen as a little bit of a luxury. I would say that there's definitely need for teachers to have good emotional literacy themselves. It's a pressurized environment that they work in. And, you know, kids learn how to push buttons, don't they? And actually, if you're someone who can't regulate your own emotions, you're going to probably find basic classroom management quite tricky, I would say. So it's really, really important. And again, thinking about how you're responding to kids in crisis as well, you know, to have that, the skills to relate to that. And it is, you know, the flip side of interventions like ELSA, you know, although they're amazing things, there's always a danger that it ends up putting this kind of intervention in a silo. And so one of the things that we're more and more so pushing for within ELSA is that teachers and tutors in school retain a bit of ownership, so they're involved in the planning, and there is a bit of a contract drawn up between them and the ELSA about what is the ELSA's responsibility and what is the teacher's responsibility. Because yeah, they're the one that sees the kid all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been 20 years since the first ELSAs were trained up. Is there a consensus that it has made a difference, or that it sort of changed the course of these children's futures, or sort of, you know, positively impacted them into adulthood?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting question. And to be completely honest, I don't think we have the data in terms of like the longitudinal stuff and the effects into adulthood. What we do have though, there's huge amounts of research, kind of qualitative research, about children and parents and teachers' perceptions of it. And it's overwhelmingly positive, you know, in terms of it providing a safe haven for these kids and helping to address some quite like specific things, you know, around confidence or handling bereavements and all sorts of things. So lots of qualitative evidence of the effectiveness, and you know, the buy-in from schools speaks for itself in that respect as well, in that, you know, Bristol, we only actually introduced ELSA a few years ago, but the growth has almost been exponential. You know, the word of mouth gets out there and we get sort of increasing demand for it. And that seems to be the picture nationally, that, you know, once it's introduced and the schools get to know about it, it just goes off. It is really difficult in this age of evidence-based science to get some good quantitative data for it though, because it's such a broad intervention. And again, that's one of its strengths, because we get a lot of these kind of quite expensive packaged interventions that are out there. I'm reluctant to name names, sure. But there are things that look really appealing to schools, and they've got this really glossy marketing behind them, and they've got a load of good data about how they work, but they're these standalone things. Whereas ELSA kind of is like a bit like a magpie, it can pick and choose. So the ELSA is almost like an overarching approach. And within the ELSA intervention, and ELSA might pick up different kind of activities and stuff to do. The only real constant is like that model of having regular supervision. And in that respect, it's kind of quite unique in a school-facing intervention that the ELSAs get 6 times a year. So every half term, they get clinical supervision from an ed psych or often a pair of VPs. And that's within a group as well. So they get the whole peer support part coming in there too.
Oh, interesting. That's really, really fascinating. I'm surprised to hear that it hadn't spread faster really around the UK. It seems like, well, why isn't like it's something that's being pushed on a more kind of national level?
And it's definitely kind of accelerating in that respect. I do think there is a tendency within the profession, and maybe I'm being unfair and doing us a discredit, but we're not necessarily the most vocal bunch. And again, that is changing. But where I say some of these other interventions that have got really flashy marketing, that's kind of, there are people that are really pushing the marketing and branding and things and getting this out there. Whereas that hasn't been the case for ELSA. It's kind of been far more organic. It's kind of just grown through word of mouth. And in that respect, I mean, it's amazing. Like, and again, I haven't got the data to hand, but a little bit of fact checking after on the ELSA Network website, the number of local authorities and schools that now offer it is huge across the country.
Oh, interesting. So you train ELSAs in Bristol?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's
right. Okay. And how long is the training?
So it is 6 days we do at Bristol. I know there are some areas where they do it within 5 days. But it's 6 days of training. We spread that out over 2 half terms, so sort of fortnightly training sessions, because it's pretty intensive. You know, you couldn't do that back to back. Yeah, so 6 days of training. And then for the ELSA to retain their accreditation, there is an expectation that they engage with supervision for the duration of their ELSA-ing, you know, because they are working with some of the most complex kids in school, so they do need to have that support, and that should be outside of their kind of line management structures in school, you know, because it's also really important for us to be able to admit when things are going wrong and we're not quite so confident. And that's quite tricky to do with your boss, isn't it?
Absolutely. Wow, it sounds fantastic. Now, you and I have worked somewhere, you know, that had extremely challenging children, and there was nothing like that in place, you know, for if you had a sort of physically aggressive incident with a child, there wasn't anyone you could kind of debrief to in any kind of big way, or there wasn't much support in place. So it's really great to hear, you know, that something like ELSA is bringing that to a much needed group of people who are doing such an amazing job, really. Mm. I think that's about it. Thank you so much.
Oh, that's okay. It's been a pleasure.
You just listened to Let's Talk with me, Siún Prochazka. My guest today was Dr. Matthew Brown, and we spoke about the role of education psychologists within special educational needs, emotional literacy support assistance, and the importance of emotional literacy for children and parents. If you want to know more about what I do, you can visit my website, siunprochazka.com. And if you want to keep up to date with new episodes of Let's Talk, don't forget to subscribe. Thank you. Until next time, take care.